Okay, great show today. We had Steve Villegas, VP Partnerships at PPRO. Great company, truly going global at the moment, really specializing in local payments methods and bringing e-commerce to every corner of the globe. We touched on his new thesis, humanizing payments from channel to customer. It's a great short white paper that I'll add to the links for this podcast. Touched on a great many things, including the consumer habits of Gen Z, the Uberization of everything, how omnichannel payments is outmoded, and many more controversial and fun topics of that sort. I think you'll find Steve is extremely articulate, really knows his payments, and we get into some real substance here. Enjoy the show. Okay, today on the show we have Mr. Steve Villegas, Head of Partnerships for North America at PPRO. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Lewis. Great to be here.
Good to have you, Steve. Thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. Today we're going to talk about how PPRO are moving their business model and I think their whole philosophy from a channel-mindedness to a more customer-centric frame of mind. In other words, humanizing payments. Steve, you're a thought leader in this space. What does it mean to you to, quote, humanize payments and truly put the customer first?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think that it's an interesting topic when you say humanizing payments, because it always seems to me that humans have always been involved in payments. But I think it's really when it comes to the new term, I think there's a lot of things that come into play when people talk about humanizing payments. There is this thought that there are many in the world that may not be able to take advantage of some of the technologies that exist today. And there's also a stream of thought that says that today's technologies will move from a channel-centric or an omni-channel type of payments to more of a singular individual customer. So when we think about humanizing payments, we think about how most of the world pays for things, right? You think about these cash societies that might not be able to take advantage of some of the technologies that we in the Western world enjoy. You're using some of our mobile and using e-commerce and things that are really easy. One pressing of a button to make a payment or tapping and paying and all of those things. But the reality is that many of these societies around the globe are leapfrogging from a technology standpoint, and that the payment systems within those countries, those regions, have often adapted new technologies or new ways of ensuring that they're able to include those that might generally just use cash as a payment method. So PPRO is focused primarily around the local payment methods globally in every area of the world. We generally do not deal with what you and I would consider credit cards, right? The card branded Visa, MasterCard. We focus in on more of the bank transfer methods there in Europe, which are predominantly, the various countries have things like Ideal and Bank Contact and so forth, and GiroPay. And then you have the wallets that very well known are things like Alipay and WeChat Pay, which the Chinese and the Asian communities continue to drive forward these payment methods that are using wallets. But then you also have these cash-based methods. And there's many areas around the world that are adopting these cash-based methods, but adopting, still intertwining with e-commerce technologies. So you have things like OXXO in Mexico and Boleto in Brazil, which require a consumer to make a purchase. Could be on their mobile, it could be online. And then they have to go to a local convenience store or their local bank, and they actually pay in cash for that item. The transaction gets completed and then it gets delivered, whatever that service or item may be. So that's the first part of thinking about inclusion and what's happening around the world. And this is the area that we focus in on is supplying those payment methods to our partners to ensure that when companies in the Western world or anywhere in the world are selling goods and services across the globe to other communities, ensuring that we are providing the payment the way that people like to pay. All of us here on this call, in this podcast, probably provide or make make payments in different ways, right? We use different cards, different systems. So thinking about what the consumer is looking at. And so when we talk about, you know, thinking about commerce and a customer-centric model, in the past, what has typically happened, and I think this is probably driven more from a marketing sense, is you had this concept of omni-channel, which really meant I, as a company, if I'm a merchant selling goods and services, I'm going to try to present in every facet possible my product and service, and ensure that anytime that a consumer is looking at something that they see me present as a product. So whether I go online or I'm looking at my mobile or I'm looking at my email or I'm in the store, of pushing my product to ensure that it's really easy for the consumer to see my product, but also for my consumer to buy it at that point in time. But so it's really been more merchant focused. What we see as PPRO in thinking about this customer centric model and where the world is and understanding that everybody is different, everybody pays different, is there's really, the customer centric model really relies around a one single store for one, if you will. So it's looking not just presenting an omni-channel of you can buy in a lot of different ways, but really, what do I as a consumer want? What am I looking for? What are my buying patterns? Where do I shop? And what types of products do I buy? And when do I typically buy? So when you think about all of those elements of a consumer and how they like to shop, that's really what this customer-centric model is. And what we believe the world is going towards, which requires a lot of things. It requires trust and requires insights and intelligence from that company. Certainly, fundamentally, there's operational things that the companies have to think about. And then most importantly, it's engagement. How am I fully engaging? How are companies fully engaging me as a consumer? And then, of course, the last rail there is making sure that the consumer is able to pay that they want to, the way that they want to pay, and it's really easy and simple. So that's what we look at when we think about customer centricity and what's happening around the globe. And PPRO fits just in that back part of providing payment methods to all of our partners so they can provide that to those end customers for their merchants.
Okay, that's fantastic. And there's a lot of substance there, Steve, and we're going to unpack some of that. So forgive me if you find yourself repeating yourself, but...
No, I know I talked a lot, so apologize. I just kind of just started going and kept going.
No, because the paper you've shared with me, From Channel to Customer, Humanizing Payments, it's only 3 pages, and I think I'll provide a link to it alongside this podcast. And you've glossed over a lot of it there, but I think it's worth unpacking. Let's look at this idea of omnichannel being an outmoded concept. So you write in your paper, I think, verbatim, omnichannel thinking is a concept of the past. Now, I know a lot of payments companies that are just now getting to grips with doing things in an omnichannel way. Tell us why they're behind the curve.
Hey, this is Jonathan from Block Data. FYI, 40% of big companies will invest at least $5 million into blockchain initiatives this year. Block Data helps these companies understand what's going on through market intelligence on the blockchain ecosystem. If you'd like to find out more, just Google Block Data.
Well, it really comes down to not necessarily recognizing what the customer wants, but trying to promote my product or service in every facet possible to make sure the customer sees it. So it's going after market share, not necessarily going after an individual customer. And obviously the difference there is me as a shopper, that may be a turnoff to me, or I may have seen your product way too many times and now I'm kind of done with it, or I just shopped there last week, I don't need to shop there again, so there may be a little bit of an annoyance. And it's less focused on what the customer wants and more focused on what the company is trying to sell, which I think most of us will agree that when somebody's trying to sell us something, oftentimes we are turned off by the concept, unless we're absolutely ready to buy, which is oftentimes what the omnichannel is trying to present, is trying to capture shoppers as often as possible whenever they're ready to buy. But there's the dark side to it, which I just talked about.
Indeed. This pivot in thinking, putting the consumer first, I think some of the research you've done for it is based on the consuming habits of Gen Z. Talk our audience a little bit through this demographic, how they're different from prior demographics, and how you need to change your business model to cater to them.
Absolutely. Well, I won't reveal my age, but an older generation pre-cell phone, right? But certainly, you know, grew up with computers and began to, you know, probably pioneers of the internet, pioneers of a lot of shopping the way it's done today. And when you think about future generations, they haven't experienced without a mobile, right? They haven't experienced life without the internet. And certainly, I think as fast as the world is moving, as quickly as people make decisions, this customer-centric model becomes more about me. And certainly, I think everyone would agree that the world is really revolving more around an individual. Individualistic thinking and individualistic likes and what people want. And so that model really promotes, when you think about Gen Z and I think about my own kids and what they see and what they want, it really is focused in around obviously mobile technology and enabling other apps and other types of ways of engagement that in the past have not been normal channels of engagement. For most companies. So it's really thinking differently, thinking about the shopping habits, the thinking about the daily habits that people have, whether that's outside of shopping, just in general, right? Where am I at different times of the day? When am I looking at my phone? When am I looking online? When am I looking at my tablet? I have a lot of things enabled through things like Alexa, right, which is an Amazon. And many people use Apple products. So all of us, I think, have different ways of engagement with the tools that we have today that we use for shopping. And it's important for every merchant to recognize that engaging at the individual level is really the way to enable more shoppers to have the products and services at their fingertips when they want it and be able to enact that transaction at that time.
Yeah, and talk us through some of the numbers there. I think it makes sense. I think we can understand how Gen Z like to shop and how payments companies can get ready to change their products to service that. But what are the brute numbers here? Because this is a growing demographic. What kind of portion of the market are they going to represent within a few years or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody recognizes as generations grow, certainly the population of Gen Z and you call them millennials, and then the generation after them continues to have much more of the buying power. So today it may be in the 20% range, but in 10 years it'll be in the 40 to 50% range of the buying power globally. Mm-hmm. And so when you think of what those figures represent, companies being ready and they're shopping today, companies being ready for that market move. Is important that they act today and not wait. And I think that's certainly what happens in a lot of times in retail. And I think you see it today, right? There's probably tombstones for many retail establishments that have continued to use the old business model that eventually found that the retail store is no longer a viable way for them to do business, where many e-commerce companies begin to take market share, where inevitably a storefront is no longer a viable thing to have. So it's those adjustments that companies need to make to prepare for the growth in Gen Z, not only shopping, but the dollars that they're associated with it, the revenues of the future, that they have to make adjustments today to be prepared for that. And who knows in 10 years what we'll be talking about, 5 or 10 years, the other technologies that may exist and the ways that people shop that will change both from a demographic as well as age and maturity as things take place.
That's very interesting stuff. I think I've just avoided being a member of Gen Z. I think I'm a last few years of a millennial. What is actually the cutoff date for being a member of this group? Is it mid-90s?
Yeah, I think it's somewhere in there. So I think I won't quote it exactly. I think there's some variance in certain areas that people think may vary by dates.
Yeah.
But regardless, there's we know that generations change and technology changes, and important to stay engaged in both those concepts.
Indeed. Jumping around, but still looking at the topic of demographics, looking now at the topic of financial inclusion and the unbanked, what can companies like PPRO do to reach this demographic and bring them into the global economy. I'm still thinking of the 20% of Chinese people who are not yet having a bank account, for example. How can payments and fintech companies reach these people and bring them online?
And it really is important for payment service providers, acquirers around the globe to recognize that the e-commerce world is getting smaller in terms of abilities for shoppers to buy products across the globe. I have friends, I buy things occasionally from Europe. Sometimes it might be a bottle of wine from Italy. You might find, I have my wife shops, she'll buy things from Australia. And so the world is becoming smaller from an e-commerce standpoint, and everybody around the globe recognizes that, hey, there's products and services that I want that maybe aren't in my country that I might need to look elsewhere. And even those that predominantly use cash are still have a large buying power. When you think about unbanked, some of this is really goes to technology leapfrogging. So you talked about China, and one of the very interesting things that's happened in China over the course of the last, we'll call it 5 years, really largely in the past 5 years, is the development of these wallets. And while I may not have a bank account, now all of a sudden I have an app that acts as a bank account. And that's really one of the lower level functionalities. Ultimately, it helps me find where to shop. It helps me find deals. It provides me a certain level of comfort in where I'm going, ratings and those types of things. And it allows me to, real time, make a payment as well. And they've developed things like you're using QR technology, QR codes to make an instant transaction. If I'm shopping, at a business point of sale, or going online and using the same app technology. So it's embedding all of these inside of an app. So what's happened in those cases where technology, because of mobile growth, it's the wireless growth, the enablement of these technologies and the leapfrogging from traditional people having bank accounts and using cards, as we probably in the Western world most associate that with, of moving just to mobile and having everything sit behind the scenes where there really isn't a bank. The actual company, like an Alibaba or a Tencent, is acting as the bank because they're holding whatever funds that you may have as a consumer and allowing you to use those funds in a variety of ways, be it online or offline, point of sale or even money transfer types of methods. So that's where the technology comes into play. And certainly communities around the globe recognize, the banking systems recognize, that there is still going to be generations or consumers that are only going to be cash-based because that's what they've become comfortable with. There's places around the globe that people aren't, that they don't trust the banking system necessarily. So when technologies come about and there's viral spread of use as well as comfort in those technologies, the consumer adoption races because it now has become even easier than it was before for me to pay for things. And so I think that's what we'll continue to see, that growth. One more example is something in Africa, in Kenya, it was developed called M-Pesa. Mm. And it's basically a credit, right? It's me loading a credit within the app, and it's using that credit to transfer to somebody else, where there now becomes this credit system that's developed for purchasing goods and services and paying people. And it's really, it's a different type of economy that's built and developed on, still there's an infrastructure that supports the foundational economics of a society and understanding that there's cash involved in that, but it takes it to a level where it's much easier to transact, much safer to transact, and certainly allows the use of new technology.
That's great. You've mentioned a lot of local payments methods in there, LPMs, and that's something you make many useful comparisons in your paper. You talk about payments methods in Mexico, in Kenya, in China, and so on. This makes me think about another stat that you've cited in the paper, which is that only 36% of US online merchants currently sell cross-border. You would think US merchants would be leading in this regard, finding more and better and quicker ways to sell cross-border. What do you think is holding US merchants in particular back, and how can, again, companies like PayPro help them sell cross-border more easily?
Yeah, that's an interesting concept, or an interesting thought, an interesting question. I think we ourselves are continuing to unpack that and figure out what's behind some of the slow growth. And I would say it's probably two or threefold. First and foremost, I think from a living in the U.S. and having worked in the U.S. Most of my life, recognizing that merchants and consumers typically gravitate towards what they know, at least here in the U.S. And because we're such a large country, right, you're dealing with a lot of states, typically, you know, going outside of the borders, unless you travel internationally, is not something that most people do. So when you're not familiar with that and it hasn't been a part of your lifestyle, shopping is inevitably follows that, right? So you have the consumer piece that isn't necessarily translating into cross-border, which inevitably flows into the merchants' probably thought processes, because obviously the majority of the companies in the U.S. are run by, managed by, and filled with U.S.-based employees. So I think it's predominantly a little bit of a thought process that it, you know, everything happens in country, and that we have the, you know, the best services and goods, and we don't need anything else necessarily. So I think that might be part one. Part two is certainly the global e-commerce, while it's grown, it hasn't necessarily been available for other countries to sell into because of the lack of payment methods, because of, you know, thinking about translating, think about, you know, translating websites if it's online, and then it's shipping products, right? So there's all these elements that when you're selling something cross-border, they have to be considered, whether it's taxation, it's shipment, it's you know, the product itself, where is it coming from? All those elements have to be considered along with how am I going to accept payment. And it hasn't been until probably the last two or three years where those things have started to work themselves through. Some of it has been led by large companies like Amazon, who have figured out how to ship all over the world. And also you've seen, you know, more shipping companies and more development of operational services that support models that are selling things across border. And you know, elements of these various payment companies as well, being able to develop their infrastructure so they can have their consumers buy things across the globe and use their local payments. And then companies like PPRO connecting, you know, that last mile of infrastructure on the payment side to ensure that takes place. So again, I don't think its adoption is also because of the growth that's taking place in e-commerce. And it's now, I think it's now getting to a pivotal point where merchants absolutely have to take notice of what's happening.
Indeed, indeed. I'm going to pick your brains on one more local payment method, Steve, because I can tell you've made a real study of this. You mentioned in your paper that in the Netherlands, a country close to my own heart, an astounding 70% of transactions are completed by bank transfers. Why is that an interesting stat? What does that mean to the Netherlands economy, and why is it unusual in the general payments landscape?
Well, what's interesting about that is, so when you think about, you know, in the US, we use debit cards significantly, right? Which is similar to a bank transfer, but it's more so, it's still like acts as a card transaction. In the US, we use online bank payments, right? Well, we may make a payment to my water company or my electric company, and that's a push payment out of my bank account. Well, that concept has been taken within the European Union significantly to these bank transfer methods, where I can actually do a push payment from my account real time on an e-commerce transaction, or link a card to that push payment as well. So what's interesting is you mentioned the Netherlands. So Ideal is the bank transfer network, and it's connected to hundreds of banks in the Netherlands that have and operated this network. And it's a push payment. So I, as a consumer, go online, I find a product I like, I buy that product within the shopping cart. It gives me the option to go to Ideal. Companies like PPRO, we redirect that to the bank, their bank. So they pick their bank method, or the banking, whoever they're bank with. They actually use their login credentials. So it's very secure, two-factor authentication. They go in there, it populates the payment amount they want to make. They authorize that payment and they push it out to the merchant. In almost real time. So it's very simple to use. It's very secure to use. People become familiar with it. And it's really become this system where it's, you know, it's real time, you know, it's coming from my bank account and it's a push payment. I also think there's also elements where, you know, different countries have different thoughts around what debt looks like. right? And very, you know, there's a lot of countries that are abhorrent to any type of debt, credit card, et cetera, right? That I'm going to have to pay some, you know, pay interest on a transaction is something that somebody, that many people don't want. So I think also bank transfer methods help eliminate any of that possibility, right? So you're dealing with directly from my bank account versus a credit card, which might accrue interest, et cetera, as well as the, you know, transaction itself could be more secure because it's a two-factor authentication. It's coming directly from my bank account. There's not a possibility of the card's numbers getting written down or being, you know, replicated somewhere else or being stolen on the back end by a data breach even.
The PCN podcast is brought to you by Payvision. When it comes to payments, Payvision don't mess around. They live and breathe payment processing, from design and integration to delivery and checkout and everything in between. The dedication to their products shows. That's why they're so happy to support merchants with exactly the kind of payment solutions they're looking for.
I can tell you, as a Dutch consumer, or at least someone based in the Netherlands, I can second all of that. In fact, it's a bit too easy to make payments via iDEAL. It's completely seamless. You can do it literally in a matter of seconds. And the downside of that is you end up buying more goods and services. So there is a bit of a downside to it being such a great system, but it's certainly one to take note of. Steve, we're going to go off script a little bit, and I'm going to hit you with a few kind of quick fire questions. I like to round up these interviews with a similar two or three questions. So sure. I'd see what your response may be. So what world problem do you think can be solved or at least somewhat alleviated by the payments and fintech industry?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly, I think as there are differing banking systems, different currencies, different platforms, and there's a lot of, there's not a real holistic solution created around the globe, right? There's all these different banking systems, different payment methods, et cetera. I think the financial systems can continue to work towards using blockchain as a future model to create better interoperability between currencies, between payment methods, and help to eliminate some of the delay. So you talk about real-time payments. That's been a buzzword for a period of time. Around the globe, and when you think about real-time payments, when it comes across border, that's near impossible to do. But as you think about blockchain, as you think about currencies, we can become more closely tied to being able to produce that. I won't go as far as saying Bitcoin is the future, but certainly there's thought process around there to say that a international currency of some sort to help tie in all the existing currencies. And using financial technologies as the driver behind that certainly feels like a possibility as time goes on and as banking systems and as world economies become more considerate of those options. So I think that's one element of it. I think we'll see technologies continue to grow around wallets where you're going to have a couple of ends. You're going to have an end where there is no banking system per se. It's an app that holds the funds, maybe it's credits, maybe it's something along those lines, like we're seeing in various geographies. But I think technology will continue to play a large part in how we interact. Certainly going back to the customer-centric model, when you think about experiences like Uber or Amazon or any of the other things that I can push one click, or I don't even know where the payment is, right? I'm not pushing anything. You think about an Uber transaction, I order a car service, I get dropped off, the transaction is completed. I didn't do anything. My card's on file. So I think, and you have things like different delivery services for food and other items and a variety of other things that exist. I think long-term, we will continue to see the advancement of those types of technologies when it comes to even buying goods and services, even in brick and mortar, it'll be even easier. I don't know if you've been in an Amazon Go store. I was in one last month in San Francisco. Great experience. You open your app, you walk in, I grab a few items and I walk out and it transacts automatically. It's geolocated. It knows what products I picked up. It knows, and it just bills me. It just takes that off my card or off my bank account. And so that experience I think will continue to grow going back to this customer-centric model and the technologies behind it, companies and payment and fintech will continue to support that growth of new models like that.
Yeah, the Uberization of everything thesis.
Exactly.
We can put another podcast together on that, I think, at a later date. So next question. What is the one thing on the horizon that you think all payments companies should be wary of or perhaps afraid of or suddenly get prepared for? Is there a bit of a dark cloud on the horizon that everyone should be preparing for? And what is that thing?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know that we ever really think about what's the dark cloud, right? There's you know, economics that can always play a factor in growth of various areas. There's governmental impacts, right, of governments deciding that they no longer want to participate with other countries in terms of buying goods and services, as we're seeing some today between the U.S. and China. In terms of some of the additional taxes that are being placed on there. So I think there's things like that are elements that could slow down economic growth, especially on the e-commerce side in various ways. But I wouldn't say there's necessarily a dark cloud per se. I think we live in a time and age where things continue to get simpler and more frictionless. I think if there's any dark side, if I had to say, it's probably more so for companies to think about and really the payments world to think about how are they enabling these technologies. Because the simpler it gets on the, you know, one of our philosophies is the simpler it gets in the front end for the consumer, the more complex it gets in the back end. And I think if companies don't partner correctly, and that really is the key here, is you have to partner with the right companies. You have to build the right infrastructure. There's no way any company can go it alone and build the system to move quickly and meet the consumer demands, meet the market demands that are changing ever so rapidly. You have to partner in those things. So if I had to say if there's any dark cloud, it's if you try to go alone and you failed in an area, it's going to be probably hard to recover. And the simpler and more and less frictionless it gets, or if more frictionless it gets, and smarter and more customized it gets for the consumers, this invisible payment thing, the more complex it's going to get in the back end. And that could inevitably cause some disruption for companies to consider. So those are probably the thing that I might say, if there's any dark cloud, those are the considerations.
Yeah, I'm fairly cheery and optimistic person myself. And quite frankly, I think it's just blue skies for fintech, as long as there are countries, nation states, governments continue to more or less get along. There's far more opportunities than there are threats. So I think
that's... Yeah, and there's regulation and things like Brexit, which will disrupt, but they don't stop, right? They don't ever completely stop productivity. It's just more of a hold or a change in how things are done.
Indeed, and there's opportunity in disruption as well. So
absolutely,
we'll see how UK fintech responds to the whole Brexit shenanigans in the next few months. I suppose it'll be interesting to observe. Okay, last question, Steve, about the perennial war for talent. Why should talented people from outside fintech want to get into this industry? And more pointedly, why should they want to work for a company like PPRO?
Great question. So first of all, I will say, having been in the payments industry for the last 15 years, working for large acquirers as well as smaller PSPs, and now for PPRO, it's really interesting, is it's a very small world. It's 2 or 3 degrees of separation. And so I will, when you start to get to that point, there's not enough talent for the growing, what's happening with growth in fintech. And there's so many new elements of fintech, and it's ever evolving. When you think about financial technologies, there's so many different relevant arms in it, and new arms develop all the time because of technology. So I would say it's not going to slow for growth. That's for sure. So I think if somebody has the appetite, the aptitude, and wants to jump into fintech, it makes complete sense. Because there's a little bit of a talent gap, I would say, because of how many people have been in payments and how large it's getting. So there's a talent gap there first and foremost. For PPRO, the reason I joined PPRO is when I think about where the future of payments is going, which is where I try to stay at, whether it's past in e-commerce, or thinking about certain types of partnerships that I've been involved in, It's really about being at the forefront of payments is what PPRO provides. And again, the world is not getting, it's getting smaller when it comes to payments and e-commerce, where consumers can buy all over the world. And why PPRO is such an important facet is we've built an infrastructure and continue to grow that infrastructure. We've got, we're privately held, but we have some major investors in the business, and that'll continue to happen. We're growing worldwide, so it's fun to be part of a company that has has European offices, has APAC offices, has LATAM offices here in the U.S., and we're still a very small company, so to speak, compared to a lot of the partners that we provide. We're a David compared to some of the Goliaths that we work with. We work with a lot of whales and even sharks out there that we support, and we sit in a very white label position, so we don't take a position of competitiveness in any way. We're behind the scenes. We're an infrastructure that supports the ecosystem. And that's what we want to continue to be. We want to help educate our customers, educate their merchants, educate the world on what's happening in payments, and really be at the forefront of where local payments are happening on a globalization.
That's fantastic stuff. Steve, where can people go to find out more about PPRO and yourself?
Yeah, so PPRO.com. Go to our site. We recently acquired a LATAM payments company, and we'll continue to make investments there. And you'll find my information there as well. Steve Daviegas at PPRO.com, and happy to talk with anybody at any time as we continue to grow our operations here in the U.S. and around the world.
That's great, Steve. Will we see you at Money 2020 in Vegas?
Yes. We will be there. I think we have a couple stands and a lot of people in attendance. Obviously, a ton of meetings going on with many of our partners that we support. That are around the globe that are there. So yeah, great place to meet a lot of people that we currently work with, as well as new faces, and to be part of new things there.
Okay, well, we'll put a link to your paper, Humanizing Payments, and a link to your contact details. So if folks wish to perhaps get in front of you at Money 2020, they have the opportunity to do so. This is Steve Villegas, VP of Partnerships at PPRO. Steve, I want to thank you very much for your time today. That was a great interview. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Lewis. Appreciate your time as well.
Okay. All the best. Bye for now.
Thank you.
The Payments and Cards Network podcast is brought to you by our friends and sponsors, Payvision. Payvision, when it comes to payments, they don't mess around. They live and breathe payments processing, from design and integration to delivery and checkout and everything in between. Check out payvision.com. We are also brought to you by Block Data. Block Data is an Amsterdam-based cryptocurrency research firm. They help investors get involved in the world of cryptocurrency safely and securely. Check out blockdata.tech for more information about them. Thanks for joining today's show. We'll see you again next time.